All right, the final matter on our oral argument calendar today is A19-1739 in the matter of the welfare of the child of J.R.R. We're here for oral argument. I'm sure council is aware of our rules here. We do have a class joining us for this argument, so we'll just take just a moment to let them get settled in the courtroom here. You'll have to squeeze in as best you can, so because we don't have a lot of seating here, but I think we'll find room for everyone. Looks like they should fit. All right, thank you. All right, so we are here for oral argument. Council is experienced in our court. You know our rules. Feel free to adjust the podium as you need to for your comfort, and counsel for appellant, you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you wish. So with that, I would ask that you identify yourselves for our record when you begin your arguments, and counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is David Merchant and I represent the appellant, MR. In all child protection proceedings, the child's best interests are paramount, not the parents, not the departments, but the child's. From the outset, in this case, the mother's decision to give up on parenting her 15-year-old son, MR, drove the case proceedings and the outcome of the case. Before MR ever attended a hearing and before he was appointed counsel or counsel made an appearance, MR's mother was permitted to admit to a CHIPS petition, force a permanency case, and enter a voluntary admission to a termination petition. This chain of events did not allow MR or his guardian ad litem to participate in all proceedings as required by law and failed to uphold his best interests. At the same time, the process followed here did not or disregarded the Juvenile Court Act's highest aim of achieving family reunification, if at all possible.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but just for the benefit of those in the courtroom, as I understand the historical facts, the child in this case was 15 years old. He was in the hospital after some sort of altercation with his mother. His mother refused to pick him up from the hospital, so the county became involved and brought the child's case to the juvenile court as a child protection case, at which point his mother made it known that she had no interest in taking the child home or parenting him and wanted to give up her rights to the child. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, Judge Larkin. The only assertion I might disagree with, and I think the record is unclear to some extent about this, is whether or not he had an altercation. There's somewhere in the record that he...
There's very little evidence in this record telling us why any of this came to court in the first place.
Absolutely, Judge Larkin. And in light of the process that led to the termination here, I would simply ask the court to reverse the termination order and remand to the juvenile court so that MR can attend all hearings with effective assistance of counsel.
So you're arguing a reverse and remand, not a simple reverse in terms of what the district court did?
Well,
I'm not sure I'm getting this because you're at the TPR appeal now, not at the child protection proceedings.
I guess you're right, Judge Werke. I'm asking for a reversal of the termination order. So at that point in time, it's up to the department whether or not it wants to pursue further child protection proceedings. So I am asking for an outright reversal of the order.
Doesn't the statute provide that if a court hears a TPR and he doesn't think TPR, termination of parental rights is appropriate, the court could order that CHIP's jurisdiction continue? And isn't that something that this court has done in reversing a termination? In other words, there was an underlying CHIP's finding in this case, correct?
There was, and the appeal was not from that order.
So that case has not been dismissed, has it? Or so my question is, if we reverse, is there still ongoing child protection jurisdiction in the district court so that a reversal doesn't mean this child is taken to his mother's doorstep, but rather the child continues in his current placement and the county would be obligated to work on reunification of the child with mom, and if the county chose to, it could pursue further permanency planning for the child?
I honestly don't know the answer to that, Judge Larkin. I know that the child, the CHIPS proceeding transitioned under the statute to a permanency proceeding. Whether or not the permanency proceeding jurisdictionally completely supplants the CHIPS proceeding, I don't believe that it does.
Don't think so.
But regardless, even if it does, because there's no double jeopardy clause for purposes of child protection proceedings, the department would certainly be at liberty to bring another proceeding if it chose to
file and start over again.
Yes, and at
for
a minimum,
the protection of the child. Right?
Correct, Judge Werke. And at a minimum, if the court reverses the termination order, it could certainly do that.
Not understanding your brief to be one where you're suggesting there's no reason for the government to be involved here and the child should just go home. Rather, your argument is that the way this was handled did not comply with certain procedural rules and did not take the best interests of the child into account as the law requires, such that we should reverse the order terminating his mother's rights.
That's correct, Judge Larkin. And that's all that both Ms. Nevin, his trial counsel, and the guardian ad litem were asking for once they finally got involved at the September hearing. They asked the trial court to basically pause, do a reset, and let this case get back to the normal procedural requirements that both the rules of juvenile protection procedure and the statute, the Juvenile Court Act, require and had not been adhered to. Frankly, had been completely disregarded up to that point.
Could you discuss some of those rules that you're claiming were violated?
Sure. I mean, first of all, was McKenna's law. As the court knows, in 2017, the legislature amended the Juvenile Court Act, and the governor signed into law enhanced notice and waiver requirements for purposes of making sure a child became aware of his or her statutory and rule-based rights to be represented by counsel and to be able to participate in all proceedings on the petitions, whether it be a CHIPS petition or a TPR petition, and attend all hearings. And that's in 260C.163 subdivision.
How do we know that the child wasn't notified of those rights?
Because there's no record whatsoever that the child was. And part of McKenna's law, and this is critical here, and it's something that, in all candor, just boggles the mind, the court seemed to be completely unaware of it, and frankly, perhaps the department's attorney as well, which is that there's two key components to McKenna's law. One is the notice requirement to the child that the department shall, within 14 days of the emergency protective care hearing, if the child is not present for it, quote unquote, fully and effectively inform the child of his or her rights.
But you
and
haven't then the appealed, second. Well, you haven't appealed that order, though, Mr. Merchant. You haven't appealed the CHIPS order. So your appeal is from the TPR order, and the record seems to reflect that prior to, I mean, I agree that there is really no explanation in the record why this child didn't have a lawyer for 5 months or a guardian ad litem, you know. But prior to the filing of the TPR, he had been appointed a lawyer and a guardian ad litem. So how was he prejudiced by considering the context of this case being an appeal from the TPR hearing? not the CHIPS order?
Well, I spent a lot of time in my principal brief, right. Judge Flory, arguing prejudice. I mean, the whole point of getting the child an attorney at the outset of the proceedings, and as the court knows, it's really a two-phase proceeding. It's the CHIPS proceeding and then the TPR proceeding. And the child is guaranteed under the statute and the rules to counsel from the outset. So you can't, at the very end of the proceeding, as the department's arguing here, cure all those 5 months without representation, because there are so many procedural and substantive issues that come up during the course of a CHIPS proceeding that then transitions to a termination proceeding, that a child who's not represented, who's old enough to know what to do and to take advice or choose to disregard it from counsel, all of those decisions, strategic, substantive, procedural, were lost, just simply unavailable to the child by virtue of not having counsel.
Counsel?
So, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just following up on McKenna's Law. Okay, so the county has an obligation to provide notice to the child of right to counsel and rights to attend hearings. Does the county also have an obligation to document the provision of that notice for the court? In other words, how do we know in a case that there was compliance?
Yes, I was saying, Judge Larkin, that there are two key components.
Okay, what's the second component?
The second component is not only does that notice have to be fully and effectively provided to the child within 14 days, but secondly and critically, the department then is required to report back to the court what the child's decision was.
Does the statute provide a remedy if that does not happen?
Not explicitly.
Well, following up on Judge Larkin's question, so how do we know? Is it a burden of production that if there's going to be a TPR or any of the things that happened in this case, that the county would have the burden of saying we notified, in this case, the boy that he was a subject of a CHIPS? Is that their obligation, or is...
I believe
or is it the court's responsibility to look through the record and make sure these are all in place? I mean, whose shoulders does that fall on?
It's both, Judge Werke. I think that McKenna's Law, in other words, Subdivision 3D of 260C-163, squarely places the burden on the department to fully and effectively inform the child and then to report back to the court. So the department has that burden and responsibility. And then secondly, and this should have been the starting point for the case, to your point, Judge Flory, about prejudice and how, and with regard to it not happening at the CHIPS phase, but only at the TPR phase, I direct the court's attention to Rule 30.04 of the Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure. That's under the pre-2019 renumbering. The current number is 42.04. And that rule provides that during the emergency protective care hearing, quote, the court shall determine whether all persons identified in Rule 3002, which includes the child, have been informed of the time and place of the emergency protective care hearing, and what further efforts, if any, must be taken to notify all parties and participants as rapidly as possible of the pendency of the matter and the date and time of the next hearing. So to that extent, Judge Werke, I think the burden is also on the court. Of course, the court is overseeing the entire process. So the burden is both on the department under McKenna's Law and under
Rule 3004 for the court.
On the court. And it's, I don't want to be hyperbolic here, but it's just mind-boggling that for 5 months, the court never once inquired about the absence of the child or did not appoint counsel. As I point out in my brief, under Rule 2502, the court can sua sponte appoint counsel at any point in time or at the request of a party. So
wasn't there a check-the-box order early on in the case in which the court check the box saying counsel is appointed and check the box saying guardian ad litem is appointed?
I don't think the box was checked for appointment of counsel. I'm not even sure there is a box for appointment of counsel, but you're correct, Judge Larkin. The box was checked for the guardian, but as the court knows from the guardian's brief and the record, the guardian was actually not appointed until July. There was a placeholder guardian. They called them the coverage guardian, but that guardian doesn't
assume... What is that?
Assume
placeholder guardian. What is that?
As best as I can tell, Judge Werke, I don't practice in the trial court, so I don't have firsthand information, but my...
We review CHIPS cases, and that's the first time I've heard of that. I'm not sure if it's like a step-in or
I think
what.
It is. I think it's they call it the coverage guardian. I think that guardian just shows up to be there but doesn't fulfill, as the guardian's brief addresses, all the mandated duties and responsibilities of a guardian. And that appointment to do all of that wasn't made until July, in other words, 5 months afterwards. But my point was that at the very beginning of the case, the court could have appointed counsel. And it was incumbent on the court to do that under the circumstances of this case, where from the very get-go, the mother made it clear that she was wanting to admit a CHIPS petition only as a preliminary step to giving up her parental rights by entering an admission. If the court wasn't put on high alert at that point in time for purposes of making sure the child's best interests are represented, when that was telegraphed to the court at the very beginning of this child protection proceeding, I don't know what would let the court be aware that it should be on guard and should have appointed counsel immediately under these circumstances. And then not only that, but as is well documented both by the record and in our briefs, it went on for 5 more months. And the only time that the child's absence was ever brought to the court's attention before the voluntary admission to the TPR was entered was one time at the first status hearing after the emergency protective care hearing, when it was the department's attorney who initiated the concern, not the court. The court never once.
Yeah, I agree with that, Mr. Merchant. And I think
that my time is up.
It is, but I'm going to exercise my authority as the presiding judge to ask you a question that I have for both of you that was unclear to me, and it's a question about the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm very troubled about the proceedings on August 16th, which were labeled the admit-deny hearing, for the TPR, where counsel for the child nor the GAL were present. The record is unclear, and it may be confusing as to why they weren't there. Do you have any information for us in that regard from the record?
I do, Judge Flory. I think that the best explanation for the court is to read the department attorney's explanation for that in the September 2019 transcript. The first time the department, that's addressed in the first couple of pages of that transcript. And what the department's attorney says there is that there was confusion because, again, keep in mind, the child had not been appointed an attorney ever formally by the court. And when the department's attorney apparently in July chased down Ms. Nevin in the hall and said, hey, it appears that this child needs a lawyer, and I'm being somewhat loose with the record there, can you represent him? And she said, yes. Well, at that point, the August 16th hearing that the court's referring to had already been scheduled. And Ms. Nevin and the guardian ad litem, who was also appointed after that July hearing, schedules, they weren't there in July to agree to that schedule. And somehow signals got crossed between what was the August 16th scheduled hearing at the July hearing and what the availability of the guardian and the child's attorney had. And they apparently, everyone thought that they had resolved that and had the right date. But then, of course, when the August 16th hearing occurred and Ms. Nevin, the child's attorney, and the guardian were not present, they went ahead anyway.
Yeah, that answers my question. Thank you.
Look at the beginning of the September transcript.
All right. And you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Mary Lynch with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, representing one of the two respondents, Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. Your Honors, I think not to at all play down the important statutory rights at issue here, particularly involving the child's right to counsel. Almost all of what counsel is presenting here, and really quite frankly what the Guardian presented in brief, are speculative because there was no development of the record. And the trial court made clear that September hearing, the September 2019 hearing, was designed to give everybody an opportunity to be heard. Counsel for the child appeared, and the guardian ad litem appeared. And then counsel for the child moved to vacate the termination of parental rights findings that issued after that September order.
They were moving. I don't know that that's a, you know, and I'm not saying this questioning your integrity or anything, but I don't know that that's my reading of the record. I mean, I think what counsel was asking is whatever happened on August 16th shouldn't have happened, so let's start over. I mean, obviously, there hadn't been an order issued yet, but in the context of termination of parental rights, I think the conduct that the, explain to me why the conduct at the August 16th hearing in allowing that to go forward just wasn't an egregious violation of this child's rights.
So the child had a statutory right to counsel. That it was a
effective counsel.
Effective counsel, that's fair. The child has statutory right to counsel. That doesn't mean a child's decision to not appear, and there is no indication that the child knew or didn't know about that hearing in either July
granted,
or September.
But his lawyer wasn't there either.
Excuse me?
His lawyer wasn't at the August 16th hearing either.
Yes, but his lawyer had an opportunity to develop the record. The child didn't come to the September hearing.
How could she develop the record if she wasn't there when the mother made her admission? I mean, she could have intervened at that point. They didn't have the benefit of that. I don't even know if they had a transcript of that hearing. How could she have effectively represented him on September 3rd when she wasn't there on August 16th, apparently due to no fault of her own?
And I would agree there's nothing in the record that indicates it was the fault of her own. It sounds, I would agree with with counsel's recitation that there was some sort of mistake or confusion that happened that resulted in the hearing not happening.
Mm-hmm.
Or it resulted in them not being present at the hearing.
Sure.
So in the absence of an intentional, whether or not it was an intentional, the court was able to go forward and clearly kept the record open to allow for any opportunity to be heard, even not knowing that there was any sort of mistake or problem with it. The court took care to protect those rights of the child and best interests, and then that right to counsel and right to be present at the hearing by keeping the record open. If the court had been going off on this sort of wild ex parte sort of proceeding, the court would have just wrapped it up then, and that was, in some senses, what the mother wanted, frankly.
At the end of the day, you know, the primary argument in appellant's brief is the record that we do have is inadequate to support a termination of parental rights because it contains very little information about the child's best interests. It doesn't reflect that the district court considered the three factors that must be considered when evaluating the child's best interests, which is necessary in any termination decision. And it doesn't provide much of any information as to why mother had good cause to voluntarily terminate her parental rights. So I'm having a hard time understanding the county's response to that position.
I do find that I think that it is necessary to read the entire record along with the affidavit to ascertain
the
good
three
cause.
Leading questions of mother. So you can't control your child, therefore you think it's best that he not be your child anymore. It's in his best interest.
Leading questions by her counsel, you mean?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And but was there any testimony presented or evidence indicating, okay, what were this child's behavioral problems? Why was the child in the hospital? What sort of trouble was he giving his mother? What services were offered to mother to help her address the child's needs? What efforts were made to find other family members who could perhaps care for the child while we addressed his needs? There's just no information here, other than mother's one-line affidavit saying, I can't control my child, therefore it's in his best interest that I terminate my rights.
I would agree with that. However, that does not mean that she does not have the right to voluntarily terminate her parental rights. I think that
she doesn't have a right to terminate her parental rights voluntarily. She has the right to go into court and ask to do so, but ultimately whether or not her rights are voluntarily terminated is up to the court, and it must be based on a determination of the child's best interests. It's not up to mother.
I agree, and I meant that she has the right to present that to the court. I do completely agree with that. It is an action of the state, and the court has the oversight responsibility, and those are expressed through the requirements for the findings. I also agree that one needs to read the entire record. That I think the best interest findings in particular are scant here, and I think that there is a confusion, at least the way I read it. The court uses the involuntary statutory grounds, I believe, to establish the good cause.
And
I
think with all of this going on in this record, why doesn't the county just say, you know what, bad facts make bad law, let's start over? We've got a lawyer here for the child. We've got a guardian who can now meet with the child. Why bring this mess here?
I did struggle with that.
And it was delayed as far as the child's father was concerned, so that troubles me that there was cause to stop and say, well, let's figure out what we're going to do with the dad, but not with this unusual situation.
I don't know that it was that unusual. It's unusual that it comes up to this court, but I don't know that it was that unusual. I would I think that the county was dealing and the court was dealing with each parent's case as it came to it, and the mother was presenting her basis. The county and the court found, the court made findings and notes that working a case plan further with the mother would be futile. And that it was best for the child to move on with decision-making regarding that child.
Doesn't signal, though, a social flaw? I mean, giving a parent the thought or the notion that they can just say, I don't want this child anymore, and what? Dispose of the child? I mean, it sounds like you're taking something back to a store.
And I think that is part of what, frankly, I think that's part of what the guardian was responding to, the guardian who was individually appointed at the end. There is, however, a need. It's not just dropping the child, as it were, is what I think you're saying, Judge.
But that's why best interests always need to be addressed, and there certainly wasn't any review of best interests of this child in our record.
The court did make best interest findings.
Best interest findings were the child's been out of home, and the child needs someone to care for him, and mother can't do it.
Which is a necessary step towards. So the
I mean,
typical
you've got
reason.
Siblings. I understand siblings. You got siblings. I mean, as Judge Larkin indicated, a myriad of things that are best interest of the child. I'm arguing to you. I don't mean to do that.
No, I appreciate that. And there is something that is beyond a tragedy about what happens when a parent acts as the parent has acted here. However, termination of parental rights is not just about the child. It's most importantly about the child, but it's not just about the child and the parent's relationship. It's about the ability to make decisions for that child. It's about the ability to get the child into a safe and stable place, which the child was not in the care of the mother. That is in the record at the EPC
hearing.
How
about this, though? Why is this a voluntary as opposed to an involuntary? That's another thing that concerns me about this case. I don't know. Is this child such a handful and has such special needs or such extreme behavioral problems that we would forgive a mother who says, I can't do it. It's best for the child to be in another permanent home. We don't know anything about the child's behavioral problems or needs. Or is this just a mother who's not doing what she should be doing to raise her child, in which case this should be an involuntary and she should have the stigma that goes with that, and we should be watching the siblings to make sure they're cared for? And it seems like we very readily terminated parental rights in this case with very little information.
However, the court was open. I mean, the case was open in court for 6 months prior to that August hearing. There was a CHIPS adjudication. the agency was.
Well, why do I know nothing about the history of this family?
I think if you look, and that's where, and I think that really it goes upon the entity that's challenging to develop some record that's seeking a reversal on appeal.
Well, no, but the person who is seeking to voluntarily terminate their parental rights has the obligation to present evidence from which a district court can make a decision that that person desires to terminate his or her parental rights for good cause, and such termination would be in the best interest of the children. So perhaps it's not the county's obligation, but it's mother's obligation, and we don't have it here. I don't think you can then say, well, once we get to appeal, it's the child's fault that he didn't make a record that shows why termination should not have happened.
I think that, but what is the point then of having any sort of procedure? The appeal is not completely second-guessing what happened. The appeal is figuring out whether or not the necessary elements have been met. I do think that the findings here regarding good cause and best interest are problematic, and that is the piece that I struggle with as to what the county should do once the appeal did begin. Doesn't matter whether or not I struggle, but I think that that's a fair question. I think that in the absence of developing any record that this is what either the child or the last guardian that appeared on this case wanted and knew about, I think there is the need to develop that record to give the trial court a chance to deal with it. And that's what I mean, to give the trial court a chance to understand and deal with the issues rather than throwing bricks.
That makes sense if the petitioning party has first set forth enough evidence to justify the district court's action, to then say, well, if you don't like what the district court's going to do, you need to come into court with some counter evidence. I guess what I'm questioning is whether the petitioning party put forth enough evidence to justify a termination, which would then sort of trigger the response, well, if you don't want a termination, you better come to court with something else.
And I think that the court did. I mean, the court found that efforts had been, there had been attempts by the agency to provide reasonable efforts in support of rehabilitation, reunification, and that those efforts had been futile.
What were the efforts?
The attempting to engage with the mother and work a case plan. And to get her to engage in the child services. Those are somewhat reflected in the pre-hearing reports that were presented.
But does that lead then to, I mean, I don't think the government was involved here. This, Hennepin County was involved here. This wasn't some private termination. So they knew all along what the circumstances were. And I don't think it's unfair to consider the actions or lack of actions of the government in agreeing to a voluntary termination here in light of those facts, that a mother who has absolved herself of any responsibility and refused to work a case plan. To me, that sounds like an involuntary termination. This child was 15, and one of the arguments that's made is, well, there were no other permanency options because, you know, a permanent transfer to the county wasn't appropriate. Well, he's 16 now. It would seem to me an argument can be made under the record that the county had some financial motivation for moving this along, too, to avoid the financial impact of having to take responsibility for this child until he's 18. I just question the county's total lack of, I don't want to say concern, but it just seems like they allowed this to move along by ignoring some really red flags that were there in terms of the lack of counsel, the lack of a guardian ad litem. And the court did the same. I don't understand why the court at that August 16th hearing didn't look out and say, where's counsel for the child? Where's the guardian ad litem?
And I can't answer that question.
I know
you can't. I would like to point out, though, that the second hearing, which is in May of 2019, there was a reference by the assistant county attorney that the child needed to be brought to court so the child could get counsel. That's connected to Hennepin County practice that counsel is not appointed for children until the child physically appears in court. So there was an explanation. Again, there's no evidence, but there's an explanation by a later counsel from the agency that the child was frequently on run and hard to bring to court, hard to bring to any particular things. I would also like to point out that there was a guardian ad litem appointed at the beginning. There was a guardian ad litem that appeared at each hearing with the exception of that August hearing.
But that was a coverage guardian,
so
right?
So there's a... That is not an accurate description. Those individuals were staff guardians, are employed by the guardian ad litem. And again, there's no record about this, so... But those are staff guardians who are appointed by... who are employed by the guardian ad litem's office in Hennepin County and appear until an individual guardian is attached to a particular case.
Does the record indicate that any of those coverage guardians met with the child before appearing in court and speaking on the child's behalf?
The record does not indicate that. I would be, given the fact that the child was not there, I would be surprised, but the record doesn't indicate that. I do think that that's an important distinction, though. And so if this court were for the failure of the child to appear at the hearing is what is, I think, at the core most troubling here, but then that means if a child doesn't appear at a hearing, a case can never proceed forward. And I think that that is not a result that can stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. Any rebuttal, Mr. Merchant?
Yes, Your Honor. A lot of what I want to say in rebuttal is in my reply brief, so I commend that to the court's attention. But I have to say a lot of what I heard just now is just striking. It seems like it's putting all the burden on my client, the child. I heard Ms. Lynch say that that this September hearing was the opportunity to be heard. I heard her say that the child was not there on August 16th. I heard her say that the case was open for 6 months before the termination order occurred. I heard her say that what's the point of having procedures? I heard her say appellant needs to develop a record. The point here, Your Honors, is that the procedure was not followed. My client never attended a hearing. He never had counsel appointed to, and he was never given notice. How was he to know any of this? McKenna's law was not followed. And I would ask this court to seriously consider, in rendering its decision here, to issue a published decision, because McKenna's law is new. There's obviously some confusion here, if not a downright lack of appreciation for the notice and waiver requirements that the legislature and the governor felt important enough to amend the statute. And I'd respectfully ask the court to contribute its authority to that effort. To say that, that this was a failure of the child to develop a record, that he didn't come to court on August 16th, he had no notice. He had no notice. There's nothing in the record. What's in the record is that the statute required the department within 14 days of the emergency protective care hearing to fully and effectively notify him of his rights and then to go back to court and report it. That never happened. There's nothing in the record.
And on August 16th, he's in foster care in the temporary custody of the county, correct?
He is, Judge Larkin.
Okay.
He is.
Is there any indication in the record that the county made any effort to bring him to the hearing? I mean, there's a representation now the child was frequently on run. Do we know that he was on run on August 16th, or did the county just not tell the foster parent to bring him to the hearing?
We don't know. Again, the only information is what's in pre-hearing reports, but then the only representation with regard to his absence is at the first intermediate disposition hearing or status hearing
quite frankly, it's a little concerning to hear the county argue, you know, this child doesn't come to court, we shouldn't be prohibited from acting, when as a result of the county's own legal action, they are, for all intents and purposes, the child's legal custodian with the responsibility to get the child to a court appearance.
Absolutely, and again, that's why I'd ask the court to consider issuing a published decision, because McKenna's law clearly, back to the earlier questions that Judge Werke had asked, who has the burden here? It's both the department and the courts under McKenna's law and under Rule 30.04. And all of the questions that the court asked Ms. Lynch about, what about this? Why wasn't this in the record? My response to that is the court's questions here demonstrate why you are entitled to have an adverse evidentiary hearing for purposes of a voluntary admission, because you can challenge whether or not there's good cause for the admission. The guardian's brief addresses that quite well in terms of what constitutes good cause. You have to have best interest in order to, finding of best interest to accept an admission. At the end of the day, Your Honors, our system of justice, including in child protection matters, is an adversarial system where parties and the child here are able to test assertions. They're able to cross-examine witnesses. They're able to affirmatively put on their own evidence. It's an adversarial process. This never happened, and it didn't happen at the September hearing. As I pointed out in my reply brief, there was nothing at all that ever gave either Ms. Nevin, the child's attorney, or the guardian notice that this hearing was for the purpose of being an adversarial evidentiary hearing. And and keep in mind that neither of them were there in August when the court and the attorneys for the mother and the department said, well, we'll hold the record open. They had, neither the guardian or the child's attorney had any context for what had happened at the August hearing or why it was being put on for a hearing in September. So, again, for all those reasons,
I have a question.
Not a question, just a comment. I know that in each of the briefs, the parties give a different explanation of how they're handling citation to the new rules of juvenile protection procedure that took effect on September 1st of 2019. The Supreme Court's order promulgating the rules clearly says that the rules as amended shall apply to all cases pending on or filed after. So the new rules apply to everything with the exception of Rule 804. So just be aware of that, and perhaps the attorneys could be aware of that in their submissions to this court.
All right. Thank you for your arguments, counsel, and your briefing in the matter. Are you done?
Yes.
Did you have a question?
And we'll take the matter under advisement, and we will issue a written decision in this matter within 90 days. Thank you.
Are we speaking with the students?
Yes, we will. So that concludes our hearing here today. We have a group of students here that we're going to remain in the courtroom on. So we'll stand adjourned for our formal proceedings, and then we'll visit with our students here. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I thought you were running out.
I know.
They might have.
I have a Skype.
That was better than you interrupting me on trip.
I have a Skype.